Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Bill Fitzpatrick, the district attorney for Onondaga County. He recently joined a group of his fellow district attorneys in penning a proposal for a host of changes to the gun laws in New York State, which became a central part of the political negotiations in Albany, leading to the Senate's passage of the new Gun Control Act. And since things can change in politics, I should say that we're talking on the day after this act passed the Senate, and it is expected to become law soon. The bill is 72 single-spaced pages, and I've been reading furiously over the past few hours. There are lots of news stories that the DA and I might discuss today, but we're going to focus on this act and about different approaches to the problem of gun violence and gun crime. District Attorney Fitzpatrick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Grant. Good to see you.
Well, let me start with one aspect of the new law, which is something that your association called for, and I think the Republicans in the Senate were emphasizing, and that is upping the penalties for certain crimes that involve guns, crimes that are already on the books in one fashion or another, but upping the penalties associated with them. And the first question is the focus of this really an issue of taking certain criminals off the streets, or is there other points to doing this?
Well, as with any penal sanction, you're looking at deterrence, punishment, and public safety. And we, for long, when I say we, the state DA, 62 elected DAs in the state, for many, many years, we've been advocating a mandatory 5-year consecutive sentence on any crime committed with an illegal weapon, particularly drug transactions. The assembly has indicated a resistance to that, and that won't be part of the governor's package. One of the things that we always see is the clear relationship between narcotics trafficking and illegal firearms, and it sometimes results in the death of people. My very, very good friend Wally Howard was a circus police officer, was killed during a drug transaction about 25, 30 years ago. And that's something that's always stayed in my mind thinking about it. So when we talk about the quote-unquote nonviolent drug offenders, I think we might want to rethink that phrase. But in any event, that's not going to be part of the package. Many of these crimes, such as robbery in the first degree, already carry serious penalties, 25 years in jail, assault in the first degree, 25 years in jail. We would like to have seen that. But what we did get was what I've long considered a loophole, was that if you possess a completely illegal handgun in your home or place of business under the previous penal law, it would be a misdemeanor. It is now going to be a felony, an e-felony, albeit the lowest level felony, but nevertheless something with more sanction, more potential jail time to it, just because someone is caught with the gun in their home as opposed to their car, shouldn't be a get-out-of-jail-for-free card.
Well, that's exactly the point I wanted to follow up on, was the deterrence piece of this that you mentioned, and that example there then maybe getting at where I'm going to go with this. But I was wondering if there was evidence that that kind of approach of upping the penalties really changes criminal behavior, or what kind of criminal behavior it might change. I can see it changing that one that you just described, because I have time to think about that. But I'm wondering if criminals think they're in the middle of their activities, I better not do this, because I better not use a gun, because if I do, I'll really be in it, as opposed to the 5 years I'm going. I mean, do they really think that way?
You know, when I started in the business 30-some-odd years ago, Grant, I would tell you absolutely. However, today, not that I'm cynical, but more realistic, I mean, I just tried a case where an illegal, handgun was used to attempt to assassinate a rival gang member, and the only casualty was a 20-month-old baby. And in dealing with the people who testified in that case, as well as some people that were arguably accomplices, the threat of jail is not something that the modern gang offender takes very, very seriously. I'll admit that they probably wouldn't want to go to jail for a long period of time, but in terms of their everyday activities and what they go about doing, I sadly have to say that the deterrent factor is not as prominent as it once was. That's not the only reason for putting someone in jail, as you know. You didn't suggest that it was. I mean, the primary purpose now, I think, as opposed to deterrence, is public safety, just keep this person away from us for a period of time. Obviously, they don't have the ability to conduct their conduct to the norms of society.
I was reading through some of the provisions related to these upped penalties, and I came across the one about guns on school property. And that one got me thinking about different possible scenarios. Let me throw this out to you and tell me what you think might happen under this new law. Let's say a father or a mother is at their shotgun club and they're shooting clay targets for sport or hunting practice. They get a call from their spouse saying they can't pick up their child from school. Child needs to get picked up right away. And without thinking through it, the parent puts the cased, unloaded gun in the trunk, goes and picks up the kid from the curb at the school. Has that person now committed a felony under this new law?
Technically, yes, but I can't imagine any prosecutor with brains, you know, prosecuting that person. This stuff happens all the time in lesser degrees. For example, let's say a person has a full carry permit in the state of Tennessee and drives to New York with the gun in the car, and then for whatever reason, the car stays in New York and the person wants to fly back to Nashville, comes out to Hancock Airport, and announces to a security guard, by the way, I have my weapon in the luggage. That's a C felony under New York state law. It's an operable firearm. It's not – we do not have reciprocity with any state in the union regarding a gun permit. But we would never prosecute that person to the fullest extent of the law. The person would either plead to some reduced charge or somehow, you know, have their carry permit affected in Tennessee or something like that. So it's not an unheard-of scenario. Now, could some lunatic prosecutor, you know, say, yeah, I'm going to throw the book at you, you know, the example you gave? Unfortunately, yes. But we hope that people exercise their discretion.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick about gun policy. I'm going to ask a question about the administration of some of these new provisions now, and I want to list a couple of them as I understand them in this law. First of all, let's take the high-capacity clips, those that are hold more than 10 rounds of ammunition. My understanding is that the new state law eliminates the current grandfather clause that was on those clips. The grandfather clause excusing those that were manufactured before 1994, and that owners will have 1 year to sell those clips out of state if they're more than 10 rounds. The new clips have to be 7 rounds or under, or else they'll be banned. And previously purchased clips that hold between 8 and 10 rounds now will need to be registered, as well as the weapons that were legal prior to this new law, but that are now considered to be assault weapons. In addition to that, we have all internet ammunition sales will be sent to a dealer for in-person pickup. I presume there'll probably be some new fees attached to that for the purchaser, and there'll be a whole host of tracking mechanisms in place for different kinds of purchases, and the registering and reporting provisions continue throughout the law. So obviously, overall, there's a lot more licensing and tracking that's going to happen at the state level. That seems like a lot of demand on the state administrative system, even if we just think about all of these new guns that have been purchased in the last couple of months. Apparently, they've all been bought up. So is the state going to be able to handle that in the next couple of years?
Could you repeat that question?
See, it's a lot.
You point out – well, unlike some people in Congress, at least you've read this bill. You point out what is essentially going to become a bureaucratic nightmare. One of the provisions of the bill that concerns me from a legal point of view is the restriction of any clip to a 7-shot capacity. The Supreme Court, I think, has consistently said that certain types of weapons may be banned. And we can discuss that later in the program. A lot of people think that the Second Amendment, unlike every other amendment, is absolute. The First Amendment is certainly not absolute, and the Second Amendment has never been interpreted to be absolute, except by the most, you know, extreme people, I think, on this particular issue. I think that if someone challenges the 7-shot clip limit, they have a decent chance of being successful because so many weapons, handguns in particular, which are legal, which are consistent with self-protection, consistent with civilian use, are manufactured with 10-shot clips. some of them more, some of them I think up to 14. And so I think that at some point somebody is going to go to court and challenge that. But in terms of the bureaucracy and the paperwork and so forth and so on, I think that there was a haste to get this bill out, whether it was political or otherwise is irrelevant. There was a haste to get this bill out and signed into law. And assuming that it does become law, as you've just described it, I don't know that a lot of thought was given. Wow, how are we going to – who's going to handle all this stuff? Is it going to be local police? Is it going to be the AG's office? Is it going to be the local prosecutors? And I think that's going to be a trial by fire, that we're just going to have to figure out how that works as we go along. But there will be – I'm almost positive, Grant, there's going to be a court challenge mm-hmm. to that seven-shot limit.
I wanted to talk to you about the permitting process for a second. You mentioned this earlier. This is the approach of trying to think about who gets access to guns. Already New York has a pretty restrictive handgun permitting process relative to other states in the country. My understanding is that under the new law, those permits will have to be renewed every 5 years. What about the idea of making that process even more restrictive? I mean, really tightening the need part of the application process so that it becomes extremely difficult to get a handgun permit. So perhaps maybe something like only 5 or 10% of the applicants get approved.
I don't know what the percentage is now, Grant, but you would find a constitutional challenge to that because the application process is subject to judicial review. But let me go back to a couple of things that you mentioned there, the process being strict. One of the things that drives people crazy is that every county has a different process. Legally, a police officer from Syracuse, New York, cannot carry his or her weapon into the city of New York, which is, you know, what I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. But legally, New York has a very, very strict carry policy. That's certainly not true in Buffalo or Utica or Rochester. A Syracuse police officer could clearly go in there. Now, you can get a waiver, but it has to be approved by the police commissioner. In terms of the application process, you know, you put down three people, you get a background check and so forth and so on. Could it be more involved? I think it has to be. And this is going to frighten some people, but give it a second to digest it. There's got to be some type of way to cross-reference a household where there is a mentally ill individual and there is a lawful permit holder. Now, again, people are going to say, wait a minute, hold on there. But just hear me out. It's going to be difficult to define it. Now, if I have a lawfully possessed handgun that I need for personal protection due to the nature of my job, and I have a 14-year-old son who needs to go see a guidance counselor or a psychiatrist because he's having emotional problems, is that the type of situation I'm talking about? No, absolutely not. But if you look at the Lanza kid or the Holmes kid out in Aurora, or I could go on and on, you know, Dylan Klebold at Columbine and Harris at Columbine and so forth and so on, doesn't it make good sense, good public policy to say, hey, hold on a second here, that household should not have firearms in it? And that's going to be difficult to enforce. It may be impossible to enforce, but we should at least make an effort. And I know people will say, well, this is the first step towards confiscation. And Grant, my response to that is always the same. If you think government is going to confiscate 300 million weapons when they can't get bottled water to the Superdome after Hurricane Katrina for 5 days, then you're living in a dream world. This is not going to happen. And I know people say, well, what about Eastern Europe and Germany in 1930s and so forth and so on? A different situation, different population, different government.
I think to go back to something you mentioned earlier as well, the provision, as I understand it in the law, about requiring the guns to be properly secured and locked away is in those situations where there is someone with some kind of mental issue, as I read the law. And following up on that general topic, this question of mental health and mental stability and the access to guns, Another of your group's recommendations, and it's also in this new act, is that we increase the state's ability to track and remove guns from people at risk and track people getting treatment for serious mental health issues. And I wondered how that would affect mental health professionals. Licensed professionals are already currently mandated reporters, meaning that they've got to take some kind of appropriate formal action when they believe that someone is in danger of harming others or themselves. This new law requires them, as I understand it, to report that fact to the Director of Community Services, and that goes on to the Division of Criminal Justice, who then are going to check whether that person owns a firearm and take it away if necessary. So I'm wondering if those mental health professionals are now required to report something that they know is going to lead to the forcible removal of the firearms, whether that would introduce a danger for them and also perhaps a chilling effect or a worry for them on the reporting, because now they've gotten into a different territory than they were in before with that person.
You know, you've encapsulated in just your short comment there a very, very difficult issue. There's got to be trust between the therapist and the patient. There has to be open communication. And you now create this informant atmosphere. And then what happens if the person who is severely mentally ill learns that the person who turned him in was his own shrink? Does he show up at the next therapy session, not with his handgun, which has been confiscated, but with a machete? That's a tough call. I think probably the genesis of this, I may be wrong, but wasn't there some suggestion that Holmes, the red-haired kid that shot up the movie theater, had made some statements to a shrink? And I think there was some suggestion that the Virginia Tech shooter had contacted a psychiatrist ahead of time. Here's the difficulty. Somebody's going to have to prosecute Holmes out in Aurora, Colorado. And right now they're doing the dance of the, you know, is he competent to stand trial? And then if he is competent to stand trial, was he legally insane at the time of the shooting? Now, if you took it before the act and someone said, hey, this guy's loonies and crazy and he needs to be institutionalized, there would be a cadre of lawyers that would be defending him in the sense that, no, he doesn't need to be institutionalized. It's ironic because now that same set of doctors and lawyers, now that he's killed several dozen people in the movie theater, are going to say, well, the guy's crazy. He's a lunatic. He needs to be institutionalized. So there's a bit of, I guess, hypocrisy there on our part as well. But this is a very, very difficult area. You know, what constitutes mental illness? If I'm depressed, does that mean I can't own a handgun? You know, I have bulimia. Does that mean I can't have a handgun? You know, how far, how overt does it have to be? Sometimes I think we just have to accept the fact that bad things are going to happen sometimes, and we can try as we might, but we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't want to have people who suddenly become reluctant to seek mental health therapy, or people who are reluctant to go to a psychiatrist. So we've got to take the stigma away from it. You know, if somebody breaks an arm, nobody is stigmatized by the fact that they go to an orthopedic surgeon to get the arm fixed. But if you have a problem with your brain, all of a sudden, oh, there's something really wrong with you. You know, you're it could be completely out of your control. It could be genetic. It could be a tumor. It could be chemical. It could be any one of a million things. So we've got to stay away from that, stigmatizing people who seek out mental health therapy.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Bill Fitzpatrick, the Onondaga County District Attorney. I want to turn to something now that was in your proposals, but it was not in the legislation, micro-stamping.
Okay.
And to me, anyway, this seems a lot less intrusive on legal gun owners than some of the other provisions that are in the law, so I'm a bit confused as to why it's not there. Could you explain what this is and how it could help things?
Yeah, basically, it's exactly what it sounds like. You put a microscopic serial number on shell casings so that when they're recovered at a crime scene, you can check a database and trace the history of the gun. There's other methods to do that now. We have a thing called NIBIN, N-I-B-I-N, which allows us to see if a gun used in a homicide in the city of Syracuse may have been used in homicides in other parts of upstate New York. And it's very few and far between where you get an actual hit on NIBIN. But we do have these things called community guns where they go from, you know, one gangbanger to the next, to the next, to the next, and you wind up, you know, you get in the homicide case I discussed earlier, the murdered little boy, we checked the gun for DNA. There were six different secretors that had actually handled the guns. It was very difficult to say, well, who was the last one. The reason microstamping probably didn't pass was because of the cost. For example, in my town of Lafayette, there's a fellow who makes custom-made rifles. They're ordered all over the world. They're magnificent weapons, and they're incredible craftsmanship goes into it. And I have heard him explain how that would be very costly to a person like him. And if you got some upstate senators that represent, for example, the Remington Arms place. So I think it was probably an economic. The bang, if you pardon the pun, the bang for the buck on micro stamping, I think there's some serious questions about that. And it wasn't overwhelmingly supported by the DAs, although I think it's worth looking into.
Well, we're at the point where we normally would do the three questions at the end. We won't do them because you were on this program last year and you had answered them for the second time then.
I'd probably give three completely different answers. I forgot what they were.
But let me ask you one question instead, and it's kind of sticking with the gun issue, and that is, what can a local community do absent the state government and the federal government? I mean, is there some change in policy or in law that the city or the county could do all on its own that would be particularly effective?
I'm a great believer in gun buyback programs when they're done right. Chief Gary McGill and I did one. And to his credit, Gary was reluctant to go along with it at first, and then he was singing its praises more than anybody at the end of it. Because what we did, which was the first time it had been done in New York State, they do it now in New York City quite often, is we involve the clergy because it's really a moral issue. And we asked the clergy for a period of Sundays to preach from the pulpit the community's obligation to turn in these guns and to turn in the people that they knew had these guns. It's not a mystery to people in the inner city who's carrying, who's packing, who's got something secreted away. And if we could have, you know, more, I'd love the motivation to be altruism, but if it can't be, if it's $200, then so be it. But if we do that, if we work together with clergy, law enforcement, and try to get people to understand that every time you turn in a gun, you're potentially saving a life, I think it's one step.
And so kind of a public health approach in a way, if we want to think about that, we're just lowering the overall risk.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the number one cause of death of African-American males, 16 to 24, is homicide. It's not sickle cell anemia. It's not cancer. It's homicide. And most of those are by handgun. It is absolutely a public health issue.
That was Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick. District Attorney Fitzpatrick, thanks so much for talking with me.
Grant, always a pleasure. Good to see you.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on the Campbell Conversations on WRVO for more conversation in the public interest.